Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday Morning Show with hosts Phil Hoffman. This morning in the co-host seat, my normal co-host Julia is off gallivanting about Minnesota. We have Carrie Logan. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning, Phil. Nice to be here. Yeah. So she's the normal one. Am I the abnormal one?
You're the unusual one.
All right.
I think it's the first time you and I have actually worked together
on this. That's right.
So this is exciting.
Yep, for sure.
And we're heading into fall. It's another season of change. Uh-huh. The days are getting a little bit shorter, nights a little bit cooler. Hiked up partway up Scotchman Peak this weekend, and the fall colors are just fabulous.
Huh. Yeah, I had to set the alarm to get up this morning. It was dark when I got
So here in the studio with us this morning, we have someone to talk about interesting fall stuff, Matt Haig, Conservation Officer for Idaho Fish and Game. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
But first, we're going to talk a little bit about the weather, what to expect this coming week, and a little bit about upcoming events, at least here at KRFY events. The forecast from the National Weather Service for today, the good news is it's going to be sunny, a high of about 75. It seems like Indian summer is settling in for a few days. Tonight, partly cloudy, a low of 47. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 75 and an overnight low of 50. And that continues on through Thursday. It looks like we have a chance of rain beginning Thursday night and going through the weekend. So if you have the flexibility to get some time off in the middle of the week to go do outdoor things, now's the time to do it.
Absolutely. So, the rain will be good for the plants, though. They need a nice, they need the start of the soaking before we get to the freezing, right?
Yeah, they sure do. And the ground is bone dry right now.
It is.
Lightning Creek out near where you live is almost evaporated again, hasn't it, Matt?
It is. It's gone underground and not much water flowing through, especially toward the Clark Fork side.
So let's start a little bit with about Idaho Fish and Game for those folks who might have moved to the area recently. Most states have some form of that kind of department to manage wildlife, but tell us about the mission of Idaho Fish and Game.
The mission, well, it was started in 1934, and it was a citizens' petition to create a department that was not driven by politics, rather to emphasize or promote wildlife for biological reasons. And our mission is to perpetuate and to make sure that wildlife populations are to stay for generations to come.
And as a conservation officer, what kind of duties does that entail?
It's pretty multifaceted. So 50% of my time is within wildlife law enforcement or law enforcement in general. We are certified peace officers of the state, just like county deputies or like Sandpoint PD officers. But the other 50% is a mixed bag. I spend a lot of time doing educational things, trapping and transporting wildlife, biological research. And we also do a lot of youth activities. We just had a youth waterfowl hunt, and hunter education is another one.
So as a law enforcement officer working with those agencies, are you deputized by the sheriff's department, for instance? Do you enforce other rules besides fishing games?
We do. It's not our main focus, but if public safety is a jeopardy, we enforce all state laws and city laws. So we don't need to be deputized because we are state law officers. So we don't need to be deputized by the sheriff. But we try not to. That's not our main objective. We deal with wildlife laws. But like I said, if there is someone who's you know, causing somebody to have, there's a public safety issue, we get involved and enforce the law.
And so what's your turf?
Well, I can go anywhere within the state, but my district is basically starts at Laclede, goes up the Selkirk Crest over to the Boundary County line, down the Montana line, down into Jordan Camp or the North Fork or the Coeur d'Alene, and then back up through the lake to Sandpoint. So eastern Bonner County and a little bit of Shoshone County.
So is it like a street officer with a beat? You're out there hiking around or in a patrol car in the back roads? Or are you waiting somewhere for phone calls to come in?
Both, yeah. A lot of times we're in the woods doing those things, but phone calls definitely direct our day. So I could wake up in the morning and have a plan, and then the next minute it's completely changed and I'm going to do something else.
So much for the schedule, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned hunter safety classes. What is usually the time frame for offering of hunter safety classes?
In Bonner County, in Sandpoint, we offer hunter ed classes. I believe it's from April through September. So we just concluded our final hunter ed class. And you can sign up online. If you go to the Fish and Game website, you'll see an icon there that says Hunter Education. You click on that and you find your location. And we offer those classes 1 month at a time. So in April, you won't see all 8 or 7 classes available. There's just one at a time. So just wait for that month that you want to take Hunter Ed or have your kids in Hunter Ed, and then sign up that month.
Are they all done over the shooting range across from the city hall? Or okay,
they are. They're at the Leo Hadley Range.
The Leo Hadley Range, right. Okay, very cool.
5 days. It's Monday through Friday, and then Saturday is an optional day. That's where we have the live fire. Mm-hmm. But over the years, we've gone to making that optional, where they don't have to go shoot, but they can if they want the instruction.
So you have a dog with you also? Is he travel with you at all times?
I do. I just got a new partner last December. I got Hudson is his name, as a rescue dog down in the Meridian area. And we went to Indiana for 12 weeks of training. He's trained in man tracking, so he can find lost kids, lost people, people that run from the police. And then he's got something very unique, some training. He does wildlife detection. So just like a drug dog, he detects deer, elk, turkey, waterfowl, and I'm missing one in there.
So is he trained to sniff out the trophy elk?
No, I wish he was. No, this is just for like vehicle searches and things like that, just like a drug dog. And then he does area searches as well, which is pretty unique. He finds firearms, casings from firearms, anything that would have human scent on it or a firearm related scent.
And what breed or crossbreed is he?
He's a yellow lab.
Yellow lab. Yeah. I love those labs.
Yeah.
They're great dogs. So I know for City PD and I think sheriffs too, the dogs have to be certified so they can is certified the right word?
Yes,
they have a certification. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is Hudson also certified so that if any of his evidence is presented in court, it's
yes,
it will,
we are in the process of getting him certified in Idaho.
Oh, I see.
So he's certified through Indiana standards, but Idaho has their own standards, which are the same as Indiana, but I have to get him certified.
Mm-hmm. So is this unusual? Are there a lot of officers with dogs out there?
Speaking of Idaho or just in the
Idaho,
nation?
I guess.
We started a pilot program in 2006. Jim Sterling's officer out of Twin Falls, and we had a 5-year pilot program to see if it would work, see if the public liked it, see if the dog actually did what it was supposed to do. And it was very successful. So last year, my chief approved 2 more dogs. And so we have 3 dogs total in Idaho. And I hope to grow that.
Having the dog with you changed your focus, your duties any? Has it expanded them?
Very much has expanded them. I cover Region 2 as well, so I go all the way down to Riggins with the dog. So that patrol area I was talking about earlier is now all the way to Riggins. So if Region 2 needs a dog, phone rings, I'm gone, down to Region 2. So
how many miles a year do you put on your vehicle?
It'll be a lot more with the dog.
Yeah. But
typically about 15,000. Uh-huh. It's not too much. In the wintertime, I don't drive all that much because I'm on some kind of snow machine, whether it's a snowmobile or a tracked ATV. So that's where I put a lot of miles on that way.
Huh. So when you have you gone through a winter with the dog yet?
I haven't.
So what does that potentially look like then? Is he riding on the back of the snow machine with you? Or
I've been thinking about that. Yeah, I might have to build him a dog box for that.
What are some of the common things you encounter, you face as challenges on a day-to-day basis?
It varies. Every day is so different. But the main challenge is actually people. You know, we work with wildlife, but it's the main challenge is people and trying to put out fires with certain situations, you know, mountain lions next to homes, moose in people's backyards. Just that urban wildlife interface is probably one of the most challenging things that we deal with. And it doesn't make everybody happy.
No, we hear a lot about the moose that wander into Sandpoint. They're semi-famous on Facebook. Same problem with moose in some of the other small towns nearby?
Nearby, like within the panhandle?
Within your area that you'd encounter?
Yes. Yeah. And Clark Fork has their fair share of elk, deer, and moose coming into town. Kootenai, Ponderay, they have the same. I live in Kootenai, and we have a bull moose that wanders through my backyard all the time. So it's very widespread across the panhandle.
Yeah. I don't suppose you can sight the animal. You have to deal with the human element first.
Right. Yeah, the animal's just looking for food and doing its thing. And so it's the people that sometimes need the education or just a little, you know, some explaining about what they're doing there.
Do you try to do hazing or relocation of the animals?
We're starting to really get away from relocation. It doesn't work. For a perfect example, I had a moose last year in Kootenai, moved it over 20 miles away, and it was back within a couple months. And the same with a bear. We had a bear out of Port Hill that we moved. I took it all the way down to the Montana border, and it was back within 2 weeks. So we really try to either haze them and retrain them, and also train people not to feed or to, you know, to have them move along.
Yeah, the feeding is an interesting dynamic. I know when I was mayor in the city, the police chief was telling me just within a block of City Hall, he was driving to work one day and saw a neighbor lady on her back porch feeding a moose.
Yes.
And he stopped and said, that's a very unsafe thing to do. And I actually don't think the city had any prohibition on feeding wildlife until we adopted that ordinance in conjunction with the permission to do the taking out at the airport.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. And that was great that the city got together and passed that.
That's
a progressive thing to do. Idaho is a little behind the times when it comes to wildlife feeding. Many states around us have a ban on it. Montana has a very aggressive ban on feeding wildlife. And the laws are there to enforce it. And it's not to pick on people that are feeding birds or it's not big government in your face type of thing. It's just to protect people and wildlife. And it's very successful over there.
So you're dealing with these issues that are, involve animals coming into the city. Do you work closely with city officials or county officials in doing that?
I try. Yeah, we do. Matter of fact, I talked to Carrie a couple times when the moose were in town and to Chief Kuhn. And just trying to resolve some of the issues that we have there. A lot of the times, the moose in town at that time of year, they're mostly cows with calves. They pose very little danger other than the fact that you could get trampled if you're not aware of your surroundings or elderly people or small children, of course, with any kind of wildlife. But yeah, we try to work with all the constituents. Because honestly, I'm the only person up here with, you know, in Sandpoint. I'm the only fish and game person. So all the help we can get, all the debate we can have, is very much appreciated and used.
Yeah. I remember when Matt and I were talking about this particular cow and a couple of calves who loved a local physician's yard. it was like within days of relocating the animal, and she and the babes disappeared. They went someplace, and it didn't have to happen. So anyway, that was pretty funny, I thought.
Yeah.
It seems like there's a lot of cross jurisdictions as well, because you're working with private lands there, but also the public domain where much of the hunting is. So there's the Forest Service and BLM, and they have some limited law enforcement capacity. How do you work with all those entities?
I work with the Forest Service very well. We've worked together. We have one law enforcement officer here with the Forest Service, and we're in communication weekly. And so it's a good, you know, basically we have the same job. We just wear a different uniform. So we communicate very well, and it's very much appreciated. I don't have much contact with BLM, just because they don't have a lot of land here. But private landowners, I try to talk to all private landowners. They have different, varying opinions, but it's great to be able to work with them. It's very important for not only wildlife, but for the happiness of everyone in the county.
Yeah, and somewhere in there you mentioned you squeeze in some education and outreach to the community.
Yes, and that's huge, because a lot of people, especially if you just moved in, don't know who we are, what we do. And like I said, we don't have an office here. So I'm the one person, and just getting out and telling our story and listening to what people have to say or their concerns is huge. And it probably doesn't happen enough. I wish there was two of me so we could do that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about Trestle Creek in the Kokanee.
Yeah, pretty neat.
It was unbelievable. This is my first time to ever go out there. I've lived here for almost 30 years, and I, you know, had heard about it, but I never went out and looked and caught it just at like the start, I guess. And I guess it got heavier and heavier.
Yeah.
That was just incredible. It was so beautiful.
It really is.
Is there an estimate of the number that go up, or?
I don't have the numbers with me or in my head, but the numbers, the Kokanee numbers have been climbing, and there's two separate types of kokanee in there in the lake. So we have an early run kokanee, and those are the ones you're seeing in Trestle Creek. They come in late August, and really about the second week of September they hit their peak. And then we have a late run, and they typically go into Granite Creek over on the far side of the lake.
Okay. Any any difference in them, or it's just that's where their spawning ground was traditionally up those streams at that time of year?
Yeah.
I see. And so does a kokanee die when they spawn? Or
they do.
They do. And so that's when the eagles are enjoying
the
feast.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. It almost looks like Southeast Alaska. You go in there and it smells fishy and there's tons of eagles in there feeding. Uh-huh. It's really, we're pretty blessed to have that.
What's the trigger for them changing color from what they are in the lake during fishing season to turning that red? What?
It's just seasonal.
Seasonal?
Yes.
Huh.
Yeah, when they're 3 to 4 years old, that's when they're going to spawn.
Huh.
And that's their life cycle is complete. They're going to go up and spawn. And that's when they turn red. And
wow, they would be beautiful. Over. Did you go and look at that?
Yeah, I've seen them. Not this year, but I've seen them before. Wow. It's really amazing.
I'm going to mark that on the calendar. I want to see that every year. We took our 3-year-old granddaughter up to see it. Oh, and my husband said, now you have to walk up really slowly so you don't spook them. And so she creeps up and then she sits on the edge and just watches. She was fascinated.
Years ago, way high up in the Lightning Creek drainage, I came across some very small pools with the lowering water had been completely drained around it. And it held some very large bull trout approaching 30 inches that were spawning and dying. And in places looked like bears had been there to feast.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Just like the Pack River as well. The bull trout run up there in the upper ends and it's really unbelievable that it's fish that size is in such small water to spawn.
I went swimming with them one time on the Pack River.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I climbed down into this big pool and they were huge and you could get under the water with them and reach out and they didn't run or anything. They just swim away. Yeah. They just would pull back a little bit so you couldn't touch them and just go boom, kaboom, kaboom. It was incredible. Big things.
So do you get out on the lake, on the water to deal with fishing issues?
We do, yeah. And we have multiple boats, Bayview, Hope, and we get out on the lake and enforce the laws out there and do a little education with anglers and just boaters in general. So that's where we spend the summer. And then in the fall as well as with waterfowl season, we'll be back on the water.
So summer fishing, fall hunting, winter snowmobile, and probably the late season trapping and all. What's spring look like?
Spring is training time. So that's when we get a lot of our training in. And then, of course, we're following up on calls as well. But spring, we burn up a lot of the comp time that we've had accrued over the hunting season and train. Mm-hmm. A lot of training. Get all that admin stuff out of the way.
What's the best part? What do you enjoy most?
It's funny. It's interacting with people is the best part, but it's also the worst part too.
So, sure.
Yeah. Just talking to people about things they love in the outdoors. Seeing that 12-year-old kid harvest the first deer, those exciting moments. Talking to a 40-year-old hunter that maybe didn't harvest, but it had the best day out in the woods. And that's what really makes my job fun.
Yeah. I think a lot of folks will picture enforcement of fishing and game regulations as that roadside stop.
Sure.
Do you use those? Is that a mechanism utilized much?
We do, and it's a very important tool. So there's two different types of check stations, and they're in Idaho code. We're allowed by code to do those. And we have a biological reasons for we're collecting data off deer harvest, hunter numbers, health of the deer, those kind of things. Then we also have enforcement check stations where we're making sure people are following the rules. And it's great. I mean, a lot of people love it. There's some out there that hate it, but a lot of people love it because we can interact. So I may talk to 30 hunters in over 2 hours. And so we can have that information exchange where I normally wouldn't have just driving around in the woods. So it's a really good tool.
Yeah. So what season are we in now in terms of hunting?
We are on the tail end of archery season for elk and deer. And October 10th will be the opener for the rifle season, the general weapon season.
Mm-hmm. And how long does that go until?
October 24th. I think it's 2 weeks. Yeah. Right. And then we get into those mixed seasons where we have the archery hunters can go back into the woods for a week of rifle. And then we get into muzzleloader seasons and then a late season archery hunt. So we're really hunting well into December.
And tell us a little bit about the trapping season.
So it depends which animal you're talking about, but the trapping seasons start sometime in October and certain species open up as time goes on. And then the wolf trapping is a big one. And that usually occurs, it starts to really turn on January and February.
What is our estimated wolf population up here?
And I don't know the numbers right in the panhandle. Our Jim Hayden, our biologist, would have those pinned down. And of course, it's an estimate because we don't see every wolf. We don't collar every wolf. It's just we use a program that allows us to just get a general idea of how many wolves are out there, and look, and we know where the packs are. So, but the numbers vary. We have migration, emigration. I mean, we have wolves coming in from Canada. We have wolves coming in from Montana. We have wolves leaving to Washington. So the numbers are always fluctuating.
Are they all the same species?
They are, and that's a huge myth that's been going around right out there, that there's different species of wolves, and that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service brought in a larger Canadian wolf, and it's simply not true. I mean, we're 40 miles away from Canada. The wall has not been built in the Canada border. The animals know no difference. They come down, our wolves go up. It's the same species, whether you're talking about a wolf in Maine, a wolf in Minnesota, or a wolf in Idaho. It's all the same species, mm-hmm. if you look at it genetically. Mm-hmm. Biologists in the 70s gave them names that correlated with where they lived, a timber wolf, gotcha. A prairie wolf. So they're all gray wolves.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What's the health of the deer herd and the elk herd? Is that something that you guys assess? And
we do.
They probably adjust harvest numbers based on that too? Or
correct. And that's why we have those enforcement check stations. We look at that data and change the hunting seasons accordingly. The deer population is astronomical right now. We have more deer than we've had in a decade. Elk population is doing very well, but it varies with what area you're in. So areas that are heavily hunted by wolves, the elk are typically not as prolific as they are in other areas. But generally speaking, in the panhandle, our numbers are actually up from what they've been in the past 5 or 6 years.
Do you think that's because of the relatively mild last couple of winters?
Absolutely.
The anticipation is a much heavier winter.
I know 2 or 3 years ago too, we read a lot about the decline in the moose population. Has that continued or stabilized?
It has continued to decline, and there's a lot of research being conducted right now. The simple answer, people say, well, it's the wolves. Well, there's a lot of other things playing in with it. The wolves definitely have an impact on moose. But with the mild winters, as you just stated, we're finding a lot of disease in moose, a lot of parasitic things. And that's true for states that don't have wolves. We're seeing a huge decline. Minnesota, they have wolves, but they've lived with wolves for many, many years. And in that state, they're seeing a huge decline in moose population. And a lot of it's due to the more warmer winters and the change in climate. I mean, they're a very glacial animal. They're almost prehistoric. So they really like that winter, that strong winter, even though it's pretty harsh on them. They rely on that to kill off parasites and things like that. So
yeah, they're also food specialists during that time of year.
They are. Yeah, during the winter.
During the winter. Yeah.
They're, people will call and say, hey, I've got a moose in my backyard and it's just eating twigs. They say, well, that's what they eat. That's what their name is. And Algonquin, moose is twig eater. So it's okay that they're eating.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll be darned.
They eat woody material, and that's what they like to fill their stomach up on, and they don't burn a lot of the calories. They're not out running around. They're usually bedding down, getting up, eating, bedding down. So they just fill their tummies up enough to maintain.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is 88.5 KRFY, community-supported radio for North Idaho, and on this morning show, we're talking with Matt Haig, conservation officer for Idaho Fish and Game. We're going to take a short music break right now and listen to a Lyle Lovett song that seems somehow very appropriate for the day. Bears by Lyle Lovett. We're back at 88.5 KRFY, and this morning we're talking with Idaho Fish and Game Conservation Officer Matt Haig about bears, moose, geese, kokanee, the whole gamut of outdoor critters.
Yeah, everything.
So, Matt, tell us a little bit more. We were talking about the hunting and trapping season, and what should hikers and other outdoor recreationists do during the hunting and hiking season to be safe?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, the first thing is just be aware that there's hunting seasons on. If you're a mountain biker or a hiker, Just be aware. You can call me or call our office and find out what the seasons are. And that's the big thing right there. So wearing Hunter Orange was a great idea. If I take the dogs for a walk, I'm going to wear Hunter Orange during the gun season for sure. You know, and a lot of times people pull up to a trailhead and they want to hike a trail, but there may be someone there hunting. It's probably best to just find another trail. But there's nothing wrong with going up that trail either. It's just having mutual respect. Hunters respecting that other people are using the woods for various reasons, and other recreationalists realizing that hunters are out there as well. And, you know, to some people, to hunting, it's not just a sport. That is their food, and they prefer that food. Yes, they have the means to go to the grocery store, but they prefer elk or deer meat in their freezer, and it's very important to them. So just having a mutual respect across the board is paramount to safety. The Hunter Orange, huge. I see people hiking or running, and they're not in Hunter Orange, and it just makes me shiver. Because hunters aren't used to seeing people run in the woods, and we're seeing more and more people run on trails now. And just that quick movement, should a hunter ever shoot at something that they can't identify or don't know what it is? Absolutely not. But it's a dynamic sport, and bad things can happen if a thought process isn't used correctly. And so the Hunter Orange is key, and knowing the seasons.
And so during hunting season, is it more likely that the animals might be on higher alert and also be triggered by that motion?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, especially, you know, you mean as far as like attacks, like predatory animals? Yeah, spring and fall, really, when bears are out, when elk calves are hitting the ground, the big boar bears are looking for that quick movement. They'll chase a cow, and that little movement they'll see from a calf, and they're on it. So if that's a person, they'll make the mistake and jump on them. It's very rare, but it can happen.
So we look at safety concerns for recreationists as not only being the hunters, but the animals. Bear spray is a good thing to carry?
Bear spray is I have my duty belt that I wear in the woods. I have my duty pistol. I carry bear spray. It's absolutely the best thing to deter any kind of attack, whether the unlikelihood of a wolf attack, a mountain lion attack, or a bear attack. Bear spray is the way to go. And just like anything, like a firearm, learn how to use it when the time comes, when you're, you know, it's, you need to be able to figure it out and utilize it correctly.
Also, food storage, if you're spending more than a day, if you're staying overnight, is an important thing. And
huge. Yeah, that's huge. They make great little packable, bear-proof storage units now. Put your food in that and get it away from your sleeping area. And, you know, make sure that the kids are great at smuggling a candy bar or granola bar underneath their pillow. Make sure that they understand as well, because that just the little scent. I mean, bears smell 10,000 times better than we do. They could smell a bird feeder from a half a mile away. So just that little scent can ruin a camping trip.
And, I know, like a lot of folks, I like to go out and pick huckleberries in the fall, which, of course, is a favorite food for the bears. And any particular words of caution as people are pursuing that kind of activity?
Again, it's just realizing that you're in bear country and make some noise. Don't, if you're going to go by yourself, sing a song, crash the brush when you go into your favorite huckleberry patch. Let the bears know that you're there, and they'll get out of the way. They don't want any trouble. There's enough huckleberries to go around. They'll go find another patch. But just to make some noise and let them know they're there.
Let's talk about grizzly bears.
Yes.
We have grizzly bears around here.
We do.
Generally, are they restricted? Do they restrict themselves to particular elevations and areas? Or what's the blend between grizzlies and the human population?
Generally speaking, their travels are all dedicated to food, unless you're talking about a two-year-old or a three-year-old bear that mom kicked them out and now they have to go find their own territory. So in that aspect, you'll find some unusual travelings from grizzly bears. They'll cross the valley from the Selkirks to the Cabinets. They'll cross from the Cabinets to the Selkirks. They'll head down further south. And we're seeing more expansion from the grizzly bears. We've had bears show up in places that where they historically haven't been. But elevationally, you're going to find grizzly bears are going to tend to the more open, higher country until the huckleberries come on. Then they're going to follow those huckleberries down in elevation or back up as they ripen.
We also have other animals. We talked about the moose in town, but the moose even out on the trail can present a big hazard.
Absolutely. That moose scare me more than bears. Right. So moose, especially this time of year, the bulls, they're very aggressive. And if you come across them on a trail or in a narrow situation, it's best just to get off the trail and let them go do their own thing. Don't stand your ground. They'll
give them a wide berth.
Very wide.
The scariest animal I've ever come across was a one-antlered moose whose head was even. So you figure he'd been that way for a while and probably not happy.
Yeah.
It wasn't spring. It was fall.
Moose with an attitude. That's the worst thing.
And the other animal that we've heard about some encounters with up here in North Idaho is the mountain goat. Proper hiking etiquette in mountain goat country.
Yeah, it's very unusual. People say, mountain goats, what can they do? Well, they're very interested, especially like Scotchmen, where there's a lot of human interaction with the mountain goats. Common sense plays in there. And, you know, over the years, we've had an abundance of people feeding the mountain goats up there, intentionally and unintentionally. We don't realize that mountain goats really like salt. And when we perspire, the salt's on our skin. And so people think it's kind of cute to have a mountain goat lick your leg and take a picture of it. When in actuality, you're doing a lot of harm to that goat population, because you're jeopardizing their safety. And we've been put in a situation where we've had discussions with the Forest Service about possibly removing some goats up there lethally. And that's really unfortunate because that all falls back on people. So common sense, don't feed, don't let them approach you. Make it very clear that you don't want the goat to approach you.
Don't feed the animals. It sounds so simple, and yet it seems like it has to be said over and over, whether it's in town or out of town.
I think if whoever has my job in 50 years will be saying the same thing. So, there's no situation where we should be feeding. And people say, and rightfully so, they say, well, the department feeds. And that's, so when we feed, that comes from a government, governor's action. He'll tell us we're in need to emergency feed. So that's legislated. So in an area where we have very heavy winter and the elk are starving and they're getting into ranchers' crops and things, that's when the governor says, okay, fish and game needs to feed. That's a completely different situation. We're trying to move them away from an area, not subsidize their feed.
So as we're talking about safety during the hunting season, one thing to touch on, I think, is the hunter safety after a successful kill. Now there's a dead animal that might attract other predators. What's the best thing for hunters to do?
The best thing for them to do is get that, to get the gut pile out. And if you can move it, quarter it up and move that animal away from the gut pile. And if you can pack it out the same day, that's ideal. If you have to leave it overnight, remember exactly where that is. And then I always tell hunters, maybe you could put a little flagging or something where you know that you're 50 yards away from the animal and it'll allow you to stop, observe the animal, make sure there's not a grizzly bear on there or a mountain lion, which is really unlikely that a mountain lion would be on it. Going to be a black bear or a grizzly bear, and make some noise and try to get that bear to be able to have time to move off rather than walking up on it, surprising the bear, and now it comes and attacks.
Why would it be unusual that a mountain lion would be on it?
That's a good question. So mountain lion typically won't eat anything that they don't kill themselves.
Oh.
They're not scavengers.
Oh.
They have their kill, it's theirs, and that's it. Unless you come across a very hungry mountain lion or one that's not acting quite normally. But 99% of the time, mountain lion will leave it alone.
Huh, I didn't know that. Yeah. We had talked, you had mentioned kind of the history of Fish and Game starting in 1934 as an apolitical organization, basically, for promoting wildlife. And so talk with us a little bit about how Fish and Game is funded and how your job is funded.
Yeah, that's another good question. So our agency is funded exclusively by license and tags dollars. So there is no general tax fund that comes to the Fish and Game Department. Now, where we do have taxes that come in is from excise tax on hunting and fishing gear. And that was brought upon by sportsmen themselves. They went to, on a federal basis or a federal level, they went to their legislators and said, we would like to tax ourselves so we have money to spend on helping wildlife. And so that there's two bills on that, the Dingell-Johnson, that's on the fishing end, and the Pittman-Roberts on the hunting end. And so those monies are held federally and then distributed to the states based on how many licenses they sell. So we do get federal money, and that's in enforcement. We don't see any of that federal money. That's strictly for biological, for research, and for education.
So you've got two pots of money. You've got the hunter paid money, and then you have the federal money based on sales of equipment.
Correct.
And they can't mingle.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, they come in and they audit, and if there's any kind of mingling, they could pull all that money back, which would be devastating to the department. We wouldn't be able to function. Mm-hmm. So we're very, very, we're very clear that you cannot spend this money on that, and we account for it in our time and our budgets. And when we get audited, it's very open.
So interesting. So you've mentioned that you now have a canine companion, worker companion.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about dogs in the woods, especially during the fall hunter season and the winter trapping season.
Yeah, again, the dogs, not only from a hunter aspect, you know, people could confuse them for a wolf or something like that, but also just with animals in general. When I walk my dogs, I have them on a leash unless it's someplace that I know very well, like the Trout Creek WMA or something like that. But having them on a leash is very important, and not running free. If they are off the leash, try to keep them at least in verbal commands. A lot of times dogs will create a problem with wildlife where a dog runs out, gets tangled up with a moose, and runs back to his owner because now there's a moose that's really ticked off and chasing him.
Yeah.
Well, you're bringing that ticked off moose right back to you with a dog. So, there's some things to think about out there. And with hunter safety, I will put an orange bandana on my dog, or a very visible collar, whatever colors that you would use that don't blend into the fall foliage, just to stand out and say, I'm not a wolf. So, yeah, there's some things to think about. And then people don't realize that there is a leash law in Bonner County. It's a 6-foot leash, maybe 5-foot leash, but a dog roaming free is actually against the county ordinance.
And especially during trapping season, a safe thing to keep them on a short leash to avoid incidents with traps.
Absolutely. Yes. If you know someone's trapping in an area or drainage, don't bring your dog in there. Not only does it ruin it for the trapper, it also poses a great risk to your dog. A lot of the times in the traps, you know, we've had dogs get in traps before, and there's a couple traps that won't hurt the dog if you get them out right away. And you should try to educate yourself on traps and how to release traps. And we offer some classes on that, on how to do that. Even if you're not a trapper and you want to know how to work a trap, if your dog gets stuck in one, they're very easy to manipulate and your dog could be relatively unharmed.
Is there a website? Is there a page on Idaho Fish and Game's website
for this? There is. There's something on our website for that. I mean, our website has tons of information. Mm-hmm. I can't give you an exact link to it, but it is on there.
Can you give us the web page for the homepage?
If you just Google Idaho Fishing Game.
Speaking of the webpage,
yes.
Recently I received in the mail a notice from Fish and Game about a breach in the license information collected when purchasing online. And so can you talk about that and the ramifications to the hunter or fisherman purchasing licenses that way?
Sure. So it affects anybody who's purchased 2007 and later.
And is it online, or if you went into the store, that data collected was breached also?
It was strictly just online.
Just online.
Yeah. So the store, Active Outdoors, is an independent company that manages our data, and they manage other states' data as well. And so some hacker got in there, and they don't know if they actually took the information or if it was just breached. So Active Outdoors sent the letter out, and they're giving you a free 2 years of, I think it's Clear ID or ID.
Something like that.
Yeah, I just signed up for it the other day because my data was the same as everybody else. And so everything, it's only 2007 and earlier. I said later before, but earlier. So 2007 and after, if you've never purchased before 2007, that's not an issue for you. But yeah, it is. The department's taking it very seriously, and so is Active Outdoors. And they're going to update their systems and hopefully get a better security system. Because it's very, with hunting and fishing licenses, you give your social security number because it's mandated by the federal government. That's not something that we do. That's a federal law to get deadbeat dads, those kind of things. And so they collect social security. So there's a lot of information in there that needs to be protected. And Active Outdoors has been great in the past. Just unfortunately that some hacker found a way in and So I would encourage everybody, if they got that letter that their data was hacked, to sign up for that Clear ID. It's free.
The other encounter a lot of folks have with game, particularly as roadkill, and with the plethora of deer you mentioned, in winter coming on and increasing the likelihood of that. In the last several years, Idaho's changed their laws regarding salvage of roadkill. Do you want to talk about that a little?
Sure. Yeah, especially in the Panhandle, we lead the state in in roadkill, and it is because of our deer population. But so now, if you see roadkill on the side of the road and you want to salvage it for any reason, whether you want to use the hide or just a little bit of the meat, or you want the skull, you can pick that animal up and you have 72 hours to report it to us online. It's very simple. You go to our website, click on the vehicle collision, I believe it's called, and you can print out a tag right there. And so you're covered. And you don't have to use all the meat. It's not like a hunting situation where you're accountable for all the meat that you harvested. If some of it's bad, let's say a deer is, you know, got hit in the rear end and the back two legs, or you wouldn't want to eat them, that's totally fine. You can take the front. One other note to think about with roadkill is you can only take the animals that are huntable animals. So if you find a grizzly bear or a bald eagle or a peregrine falcon or a red tail, you cannot pick those up. Those are animals that cannot be salvaged because you can't have them in possession. So, and it's been a great program. People are utilizing it for all sorts of things. And I've noticed that the highways are much clearer. You don't see as many animals laying there. And the Idaho Department of Transportation does an excellent job of picking those animals up that aren't salvaged.
We're running a little short on time. Any interesting stories to share?
Oh, boy, put me on the spot, huh?
that you can repeat in public.
That's hard. That's the hard rule right there. The other day we went down, a neighboring officer, Rob Morris out of Sagal, we went down and investigated. A gentleman called in, wanted us to look at a mountain lion kills, you know, right by his house. And we thought, okay, sure. Well, you know, you never know what we're going to see. Sometimes we get mountain lion calls and they're the neighbor's cat. Well, it's very interesting. But we went down there and sure enough, within 20 feet of his house, there was three mountain lion kills that were cached just like a mountain lion would, covered up. And just amazing what wildlife can do right there in front of your eyes. And yeah,
they're not predictable.
Not at all.
So what's your involvement with bird hunting? Duck season, goose season, that kind of thing?
Very much involved. We cover all that. We don't have any specifics. I don't just cover fishing or just big game hunting. So we're involved in the waterfowl hunting as well. And you know, that season's right around the corner. So we'll be out enforcing that.
That starts in October, right?
It does. October 1st, I believe, is the date this year.
Yeah. And what are the projections? I mean, those are probably federal numbers, but do you guys have a sense of the numbers of birds this year?
It should be a good year. It's all based on what Canada has as far as weather. Mm-hmm. If they have good nesting, wet, so there's the pothole water is there for the birds to nest. They like that and need it. So this year should be pretty good. The limiting factor here in Bonner County is our water. So if we get an early freeze up, those ducks are gone. They're going down to southern Idaho. Mm-hmm. And then what's really changed it as well is the lake level going down to 2051. It not only ruins access for hunters, just for recreationalists too, but the birds can't get to the food source. So now you have deeper water where the puddle ducks that, you know, tip up when they eat, not the divers, they can't get to food. And so they're going somewhere where they can. Hmm. So that the lake level's really affected our waterfowl population through the winter.
Except at City Beach.
Except at City Beach with geese. Yes. Well,
I think that opens up a whole another can of worms. I mix metaphors too much. But,
Speaking of the city, though, do we have a moment to ask about the new? Okay. Yeah. At the airport, yes. I think there was I didn't read it in detail, but I think there was a new agreement with the city regarding the taking of deer out at the airport. Could you give us a little detail about that?
Sure. So over the years, there's been some concern about deer and public safety with planes, and there has been some impact. Planes have hit deer. And so we worked with the airport, and we're allowing them to trap deer. They're doing it on their own. And if for some reason the deer get hurt, or if they can't get them transplanted, they're dispatching the deer and they're giving it to the local food bank. And that's a good program because the public safety and the property end of things is very important. And in our discussion with the airport, I believe they're getting a grant, a federal grant from the FAA to build a fence, which a lot of airports do, especially with that amount of traffic that they have there, is paramount to safety.
If they can perfect the deer-proof, moose-proof fence, there'll be a lot of gardeners that will want their design.
Yes.
Think tall. I think you're talking a 9-foot fence or something like that.
Well, that would be ideal.
Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. If there's ever any seasonal updates you want to provide, let us know. Come back.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having me here.
If you're just tuning in and you're missing most of the show, you can listen to this in the next few days as a podcast. We've been talking with Matt Haig, Conservation Officer for Idaho Fish and Game. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Phil.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Carrie.
We're going to take a short break for a little Taj Mahal fishing blues, and then Carrie and I will be back with some of the community events and upcoming information on KRFY's morning show. Taj Mahal, the fish and blues. We had a great show this morning, didn't we, Carrie?
Yes, we did.
Talked about fish and blues, the moose blues.
Lots of stuff.
Lots of stuff. So if you're interested in the KRFY morning show for tomorrow morning, join hosts Chris Bessler and Susie Perez. They're kicking off the Local Decision 2016. They've invited both Idaho's U.S. House of Representative candidates, James Petrowski and Raul Labrador, on the show to be interviewed. So tune in and hear their stands on important issues. That's 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And Carrie, I think you've got the whole lineup of Local Decision.
I've got the whole rundown. So on October 5th, we'll have Bonner County Sheriff Race with candidates Daryl Wheeler and Terry Ford. On October 12th, District 7 House Seat A with candidates Jessica Chilcott and Priscilla Giddings. And District 7 Senate candidates Ken Myers and Carl Crabtree. Those are on October 12th. On October 19th, District 1 House Seat B candidates, Sage Dixon and Stephen F. Howlett. On October 26th, District 1 House Seat A candidates, Heather Scott and Kate McAllister. And on November 2nd, District 1 Senate, current Senator Sean Keogh and Steve Tanner. And then November 9th, the day after the election, there'll be a recap with local print media reporters. So I imagine somebody from the Reader and somebody from the Bee and that kind of thing.
Local policy wonks.
Yeah.
I believe also
policy nerds.
KRFY will be rebroadcasting each of those at 5 p.m. on Fridays for those who might have missed the show and prefer to listen, I guess not live, but pre-recorded.
And there'll be podcasts also.
And there'll be podcasts usually up the next day. So stay informed.
And then there's a candidate forum, but we aren't exactly clear between us about what the date is. I think it's in October sometime.
I believe so. I'm sure there is.
Usually at the high school auditorium. And I'm sure there'll be more info on that coming up soon.
So if you have any questions for these scheduled guests on the KRFY Morning Show, you can give us a call at 265-2992 or email us at krfyradio@gmail.com. Coming up later this week on the morning show on Thursday, Carrie, you're going to be back in the studio with Jack.
Going to be back with Jack.
Yep. Looks like you'll be talking with Olivia Luther-Moreland and Cameron Murray from the Bonner County History Museum.
We've talked with Jack and I talked with Cameron maybe 2 months ago or so and heard about the lineup for the summer. So it'll be interesting to hear how successful those events were. And I understand they were quite successful. Yeah. And Olivia and I actually serve on City's Historic Preservation Commission together.
And I know there's an event coming up this weekend. Jack Nesbitt's going to be back in town, or at least at the Odin Grange Hall, to be talking about a reading from his upcoming book and the discovery of a meteorite carried by a glacier from British Columbia down to the Willamette Valley.
Whoa.
Which it sounds like quite an interesting tale.
Yeah, for sure.
Next Tuesday's morning show, Julie will be back in the studio with me. We'll be talking with Eric Morgan from the Forest Service all about fire. Fire updates on the season, maybe a little bit of the history from last season, and a lot about prevention, how to fireproof or at least fire resist your property. So tune in next week.
Will you be asking a question about the morel season this year in relationship to fire? Because I understand it was phenomenal.
We'd be remiss to not talk about morels and fire. So in local events, the Ambassadog finalists have been announced. Apple, Austin, Falcon, Mago, and Rosie, with alternates Lola and Winston. So I'm not quite sure exactly how the process goes from here, but those are the finalists, and undoubtedly there'll be some more vetting. I didn't see Matt's canine companion dog. There may be an official conflict of interest.
Hudson. Well, his name is Hudson.
Hudson. Mm-hmm. Upcoming events this week. We've got time for just a few. The highlights include, where did the highlights go? We have a Food for Children benefit. That's this evening, or tomorrow evening, Wednesday. Yappy Hour and more on the Ambassador Dog will be Thursday. Manhattan Film Fest will be Friday through Sunday. And it's Oktoberfest out at the Hope Memorial Center this Saturday. Mm. And, of course, the Jack Nesbitt we were just talking about. You can find out more information on those events and more at sandpointonline.com.
And don't forget Farmer's Market on Saturday. Well, on Wednesday and Saturday.
Yep,
should be
right.
Fabulous on Saturday.
We're coming down to the close of the season. Yep. My garden's still producing flowers for the bean plants.
Oh, wow.
It's just amazing. It's been a late bloom for the beans this year.
Huh.
But we live in a little bit of a zone that gets a later frost than most.
I see.
So we're going to go out here with a little bit of music from the Eagles. To honor the last couple mornings of just wonderful sunrises, Tequila Sunrise.
Nice working with you,
Phil. It's been fun. It's been fun, Carrie. Welcome back.
Thank you.